fiction. Today, we begin the day of facts. Let me introduce you to our panel. First up, Mary Wojtek, Director, Astrobiology Program, NASA Headquarters, who will lead the panel discussion and help facilitate the Q&A. Felisa Wolf-Simon, the lead researcher for the finding in NASA Astrobiology Research Fellow. Stephen Benner, Distinguished Fellow, Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution, Gainesville, Florida. Pamela Conrad, astrobiologist, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. And joining us via phone from Tempe, Arizona, James Elser, professor, Arizona State University. And with that, I turn it over to Mary.
Thank you all for joining us today. Today's report is going to be on a life from Earth that was discovered that does something very unusual. It is terrestrial life, but not life as we know it. This research was funded by the Astrobiology Program, which is a research and analysis program in NASA that focuses on the origin and evolution of life, the distribution of life, and the future of life on Earth to inform us as to how we might search for life or evidence of life in other places in our solar system and beyond. NASA has had a long history of funding origin of life research. In fact, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. And the research that's going to be presented here today exemplifies the goals of our program and our interest in the origin of life and life in the universe. I'd like to introduce Dr. Felisa Wolf-Simon, the lead author on the paper, to fill us in on what she did and what she found.
Thanks, Mary. Well, as Mary probably knows, and as many of my colleagues would agree with, I'm always interested in exceptions to the rule. And what I'm going to talk about here today is not that much different than another exception to the rule. And so I've led a team that has discovered something that I've been thinking about for many years. And I've been thinking about an idea of substitutions. And what does it mean to be substitution? And what does it mean to be toxic? So I've led a team that has discovered a microbe that can substitute arsenic for phosphorus in its major biomolecules. But let me step back for a minute. All life that we know of requires carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. And it uses those six elements in some of the critical pieces I think we're all familiar with, including DNA and RNA, or the information technology of the cell, the proteins, which are the molecular machines, and the lipids, which separates you from everything else. And so by discovering, we've discovered an organism that can substitute one element for another in these major biomolecules. So I want to put that in the context of the who, what, where, and how we did this, and give us a little bit about, in an astrobiological context, or life in a planetary context, of what this could mean to us on practical and also a bit more esoteric levels. I'd like to introduce to you today the bacterium GFAJ-1. These are not little potatoes. They are a microbe that scientists lovingly call little bugs, but they're not bugs, they're microbes. And this is a bacterium that, although looks ordinary, and this may look like a type of micrograph many of us may have seen in different places, but it's doing something extraordinary. And so we'll talk about that. But first, let's find out where this microbe is from. Here we're looking at a map of Mono Lake, California. It's in Northern California and east of the Sierras, just outside of Yosemite National Park. It's a very interesting environment, and we're gonna take a look at that. If we could please roll that footage. Mono Lake is 3 times the salt of seawater, a pH of 10. It's basic, like bleach. And it's got very high levels of arsenic. And it's teeming with life. So the seemingly inhospitable environment teems with life, like bacteria and algae and brine shrimp, and is a major stopping point for migratory birds on their way through the United States. And we went to look for an interesting microbe, and we went to an unusual place. So let me tell you a little bit about how we did this. So if you want to look for an organism that can substitute one element for another, you might want to think about where that particular element is abundant, and Mono Lake is abundant in arsenic. But why would I come up with the idea of substituting arsenic for phosphorus? If we think about the periodic table, Arsenic lies just below phosphorus on the periodic table, and so they actually have the physical size of arsenic and phosphorus are very similar. We call it the atomic radii, but it's the physical size of the atom, as far as we can tell, is very, very similar. And actually, the fact of this chemical similarity, and there's other things I'd be happy to discuss at length with folks, but that chemical similarity lends insight into something that arsenic is toxic because it looks like phosphorus. So your cells and my cells and microbial cells, they can't tell the difference. And that's very interesting to me as a biochemist. So I went to an environment to look for this particular microbe, and what we did, we took the muds of Mono Lake that we just were introduced to, and we wanted to see if anything would grow. If we took that mud and we gave it a laboratory environment that was rich in everything else it needed, sugar, vitamins, not that bad for us, and we added no phosphorus and added very high doses of arsenic. It was a double whammy, you could think of it. This is not an experiment that most people might run, but it was driven by my question, is there a microbe on Earth that could substitute arsenic for phosphorus in its basic biomolecular constituents? And so what did we find? We found that not only did this microbe cope or deal with the toxicity, we might say, with arsenic, but it grew and it thrived. And that was amazing. Nothing should have grown. Put your plant in the dark. It doesn't grow. So something grew. But now we wanted to find out what was happening. So we measured the insides of the cells. We took the cells and we measured the total arsenic concentration inside the cells. It was taking up this arsenic. That's unusual. And then we found that the arsenic was associated specifically with a band of genomic DNA. And so we isolated the genomic DNA. I think a lot of us have heard this kind of thing. We measured that there was arsenic there. And then we could tell that the arsenic wasn't just stuck. It was in an analogous type of chemical environment, or its nearest neighbors looked like it was behaving like phosphorus. So it was associated, it was inside the cell, it was somehow associated with the DNA, and it had this chemical environment, or it had an analogous sort of, it's like sitting at a dinner table, and you and your neighbors, and how we might see that you were all around. Well, what should be in the place of phosphorus looked like it was arsenic. We measured it as arsenic. And so let's look at an artist's rendition of what we think is going on in the cell. Let's roll that animation, please. So here we're seeing the beautiful, elegant structure of the double helix of DNA. And what I want to highlight is the phosphate backbone, we say, and that's the light orange balls. And it stitches together as we see the edges of DNA. It holds together the DNA, the backbone. And so what we think is happening, what all the evidence we've collected suggests, is that instead of these, we'll see these orange, light orange balls disappear. And represented by green balls, we see that arsenic would be substituting for phosphorus in the backbone of DNA. And you can see how critical this component of the DNA might be. So what I've presented to you today is a microbe doing something different than life as we knew it. I was taught as a biochemist that all life on Earth, all life we know of, to harken back to the pale blue dot ideas of Carl Sagan, all life we know of is here so far. And if there's an organism on Earth doing something different, we've cracked open the door to what's possible for life elsewhere in the universe. And that's profound, and to understand how life is formed and where life is going. This microbe substitutes arsenic for phosphorus in its basic biomolecules. And what else might we find? What else might we want to look for? Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Felisa. It's very exciting, of course. We have several other people up here and joining us from Arizona. The next person who will be speaking is Dr. James Elser. He's a professor of ecology, evolution, and environmental sciences in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State, joining us from Tempe. His background is in ecology, and he's going to put into context the importance of phosphorus and why this substitution of this is of interest. Jim?
Hello, everyone. Greetings from sunny Tempe. It's a very exciting day. Congratulations to Felisa and her team on this really stimulating report that's coming out. And someone who's studied phosphorus for a long time, it's really quite surprising that we're having this discussion. So what I want to do for everyone, though, is try to place phosphorus in the context of ecology and the environment and evolution and how important it is for human beings and the operation of our society. So if I could just bring up the first slide there. So what we know from a lot of studies in ecology is that phosphorus is often limiting to the growth of all kinds of organisms, bacteria, algae, higher plants, even higher animals themselves. And this picture from the Tennessee Valley Authority shows quite clearly that phosphate added on the right-hand side of the picture is limiting also to crop plants. And so we add a lot of phosphorus in fertilizer. And in fact, phosphorus-based fertilizers are one of the pillars of the green revolution. So phosphorus is limiting in a lot of different ecosystems, and it's limiting for the reasons that Felisa described, because life as we know it, organisms that we know around us, rely on phosphorus to build nucleic acids and other molecules that they need to grow and proliferate. So phosphorus is well known to be extremely important for all kinds of organisms and ecological systems. So if we go on to the next one, because phosphorus is limiting and everything needs it, it often turns out also that when phosphorus leaks out of systems, like out of agricultural fields or out of cities or such, it functions as a pollutant. And here you can see a lake on the bottom half has received phosphorus. The top side has only received carbon and nitrogen. The bottom side has received carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. So phosphorus is necessary to have massive algal blooms that lead to the greening of lakes like this and eutrophication. So phosphorus is a big issue for sustainability and the quality of aquatic ecosystems. So we know that phosphorus, because it's limiting, because it's so important to organisms, often functions as a pollutant when it leaves human hands. Now if we go on to the next slide, we can also start to talk about, well, where does this phosphorus come from that we use in fertilizer? Well, it comes from just a few places around Earth. It comes from mines of phosphorite deposits that were built up over tens of and hundreds of millions of years by biological processes. These mines are located in just a few countries around the world. The United States has phosphorus reserves in Florida and North Carolina that are rapidly being depleted because of fertilizer consumption. Morocco has major phosphorus reserves, as does China, but the distribution of this resource is relatively scarce around our planet. And so because of this scarcity and its geographic distribution, and because of the burgeoning demand for phosphorus fertilizer, there's some concern, if we can see the next slide, please, among scientists that the supplies of phosphorus that support the green revolution and high agricultural production might become scarce, at least supplies of cheap phosphorus. And so we need to get a lot cleverer about phosphorus in society, and it's really exciting to think about the possibilities that are raised by a clever organism that has evolved away to do without phosphorus, possibly, as we're talking about today. So if we go on to the next slide. So as I think about the ramifications for the possibility of an organism that doesn't use phosphorus, the possibilities start to run away to think about how it might be used in wastewater treatment, how it might be used in recovering phosphorus from various sources, how it might be used in bioenergy production, and other sorts of possibilities. So really, we have a new way of thinking now if this study holds up, that there are organisms that are possibly able to grow without phosphorus. And as someone who's studied phosphorus for my entire career, essentially, and who regularly gives lectures about phosphorus, in which I state that every living thing uses phosphorus to build its DNA, the idea that I'm sitting here today discussing the possibility that that's not true is quite shocking. So, Felisa, I have to thank you and blame you for making our lives somewhat more difficult. So it really is quite a remarkable report in the context of how what we know about phosphorus and its importance in ecosystems.
So thank you, Jim. It sounds to me like you're going to need to go out and find a new textbook to teach all those students about what elements are used to build life.
Well, I don't know about a whole new textbook, but certainly some paragraphs and sentences are going to have to be rewritten as of today.
Give me some time, Jim. I'm at the beginning of my career, so see you on the back end of that.
Okay, Felisa. I'll be happy to review it. I'll get started.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Our next speaker is Dr. Steven Benner, from the founder and distinguished fellow from the Foundation of Applied Molecular Evolution. And he spent a lot of his life as an organic chemist and studying the chemistry of life. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm the curmudgeon here. I'm the chemist who has been brought in, as Felisa knows, to throw wet blankets on things and to try to damp a little bit the enthusiasm. My next 3 minutes will be successful if I convey to you folks why chemists think that this is an exceptional result, and why, therefore, chemists will, like Carl Sagan says, require exceptional evidence to support it. And I also want to make sure you folks understand why we nonetheless find it interesting. What Felisa has found, of course, is a microbe that grows in the environment which has a lot of arsenic and very little phosphorus. The Astrobiology Institute, which we are parts of, is the one place in American science where you can go to find geologists and microbiologists and astronomers and chemists together, where we can have the productive clash that leads to big discoveries about big questions. What is life? What could alien life look like? And so my goal in the next 30 seconds or so is to try to give you as a layman the understanding of how this is an exceptional result, how it might be looked at in greater detail, because one thing that will survive is the Felisa's microbe, and that will be an excellent system to explore questions about how arsenic is tolerated and phosphorus is limited in organisms that are placed under environmental stress. So I brought my Richard Feynman props with me, which is a representation of a molecule, right? And these molecules are, say, representing a biopolymer, and of course we're making them out of steel, and the result is that it's tough. Right? And of course, as Felisa has mentioned, arsenate is made out of, in this particular case, aluminum foil. And of course, it's not as tough as steel, but when a bacteria is going to try to form a new chain, it's going to try to find in the environment the links that go to form the chain. And of course, if there's arsenate around as a weak link, it will maybe confuse and maybe deceived by the structure of arsenate and the similarities to join two chains together, not by a steel chain, but rather by an arsenate chain. And of course, these are compounds that have been studied in model form. This specific arsenate DNA has actually never been isolated, but there are compounds that are similar to it. Different kinds of atoms, but still carbon, oxygen, arsenic, oxygen, carbon linkages. And so we know that they're relatively unstable. They fall apart with half-lives measured in the order of minutes, conveniently. And so when you try to put them into a DNA molecule, right, and then you put it under stress, they fall apart, and then, of course, your biological system says, oh, my God, I've just destroyed my molecule. I've got to go back again. So, again, if there's arsenate in the environment, right, you can get the story. You waste a lot of energy and a lot of time trying to put into DNA backbone arsenate, where if the arsenate ester falls apart, you're effectively saying that arsenate is the, I guess we call it the wolf, demon wolf or demon sheep in sheep's clothing. It fools the enzymes into taking it instead of what it should take. There are two ways that biological systems in general can manage this. One way, of course, is to get very good at distinguishing between sheep and wolves in sheep's clothing, and therefore the end result is, of course, that you don't get fooled by the analog. The other possibility, it's also conceivable, that the biological system can have evolved to manage the weak link. And they might manage the weak link by, for example, binding something to the weak link, sequestering it, keeping it tight. But the difficulty that we're having, or in fact, almost anybody with chemistry who is familiar with this literature will say is, well, wait a minute. This DNA molecule has allegedly been isolated away from the other molecules in the biological system. So we remember all this old chemistry, and we don't believe it. And that's what you're going to see a lot of people saying. Now, keep in mind, old chemistry can be wrong. And in fact, one of the wonderful things about being in a science is, as Richard Feynman would say, science begins when you distrust experts. And of course, as the expert in chemistry, I'm saying that you should distrust me. But the bottom line out of all this is that what you're looking at here is an exceptional claim based on the context of the chemistry. And of course, when we can go into great details about what experiments you might do in the future to explore this, but what Felisa has produced is a very, very useful system to go ask these kind of questions. One last point. Remember, the weakness of the link is a weakness measured at room temperature, 35, 37 degrees centigrade, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, in water. If you go to an exotic environment, and the National Academy of Sciences produced a book, which is actually you can go have, it's coming out of the National Research Council, called The Limits of Life in Organic, Limits of Organic Life in Planetary Systems. You realize that in our solar system there are places, Titan, a moon of Saturn is one of them, where the temperature is much lower, where very reactive species like arsenate could very well be useful because, although they're too unstable to exist in many environments on Earth, they're not too unstable to exist in an environment like Titan, which is at minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a cold environment. And in fact, you might very well want to have the increased reactivity of arsenate in that environment just to get the reactions that you want to make your biopolymer chains go a little bit faster. So again, my role as the curmudgeon is to say, this is an exceptional result. I hope I can convey to you a little bit, maybe not in technical language, but in graphic language, why the chemist views this as an exceptional result. And so you will understand why in the NASA astrobiology program over the years, as these various disciplines of chemists and who are the doubters or the deniers, the microbiologists, the geologists, will interact in a way to bring forward the process that science is, which is, of course, the clash of contradicting cultures in an effort to come up with the truth, to inspire, of course, Americans' youth to go through the effort of studying science, so they knowing full well that there are these kinds of very interesting questions out there, like what is life and where might we find it, if not on Earth.
Thank you, Steve. I have a question for you. So, would you, as an organic chemist, consider replacing your graduate students with microbes?
There
are
many
explore these reactions.
Many of my graduate students are undoubtedly watching, and I love you all, and I wouldn't think of replacing you.
Okay, fair enough answer. Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Pam Conrad. She is a planetary scientist at the Goddard Space Flight Center and also the deputy PI in an investigation that will be flown on the Mars Science Laboratory to be launched in a year from now. It's the first astrobiology mission since Viking, whose goal is to look for evidence of habitability and the potential for current and past life on Mars. Please, Pam.
Well, I don't think I'm going to classify myself either as curmudgeon or otherwise. My role in the astrobiology spectrum is to think about how we might predict the habitability of environments off the Earth. And the way I go about that is to see what I can learn about environments on the Earth and try to develop metrics for habitability. So I find this result delightful because it makes me have to expand my notion of what environmental constituents might enable habitability. So for example, if you just think about an environment in terms of what it's made of and how those things are arranged, you have a concept of an environment just like the chemical environment. Everything is a function of its constituents and how they're arranged. So what is really interesting about this result is if you can make a biomolecule that has substitutions in it, the properties have to change as a function of new constituents. So it opens up a whole new line of questioning. What might those changes be? What do they portend for the evolution of that chemistry? What do they mean about the environment? And by the same token, we might learn something new about habitable environments by understanding how organisms that are there adapt to the presence of new or limited chemical constituents. With respect to space exploration, this is a very interesting result again, because the implication is that we still don't know everything there is to know about what might make a habitable environment on another planet or a satellite of another planet. We have to increasingly broaden our perspective. So perhaps arsenic is not an essential component for habitability or for life, but it may be one that can be tolerated and that opens up our perspective to try to understand what other potential components might be tolerated or, in fact, even essential that we presently haven't thought of.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to bring this all around and back to Felisa, for her to put her findings in a broader context for us and remind us of exactly what they are and their importance.
So let's remind us what we've learned here today. I'm interested in exceptions, and I think many of us are interested in those exceptions to the rules. Why are things constants in nature? That keeps me up at night. Why? I was probably a very difficult child in junior high and high school. But what I'll say is that kind of openness to questions is part of what I hope that the work of myself and my team that produced this What I want to really reiterate is it's not about arsenic, and this isn't about Mono Lake. It's about thinking about life in a planetary context and asking questions, simple questions, with a simple experimental design. And so, in like a bigger scale, let's go from the small, and then we'll go into the abstract. All life on Earth required carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. So I've shown here today that we've discovered a microbe that can substitute arsenic for phosphorus in its major biomolecules. Not just DNA, but things like ATP, that many of those high school students out there, I hope, recognize. And also all sorts of other biomolecules. What does that suggest? It cracks open the door to the potential. You know, my niece asks me, how did we get here? And are we alone in the universe? And it's profound that we don't know the answers exactly to that yet. Maybe not in my lifetime, but maybe in her lifetime, she'll be able to be able to answer that. But I hope my work serves as a proof of concept that we can experimentally test and show evidence of what else is possible. So I'd like to roll some footage just to give us the expansive nature of life, from microbes to crustacea, to bugs, to mammals, to everything you know that's alive on planet Earth. Again, hearkening back to the idea of the pale blue dot. Understanding life here, all sorts of life, lions and tigers and bears. And how everything we know is on this tree of life. Everything you've ever thought of so far that we can see on this tree of life. So what we're presenting here today is a member of this tree of life. We're cracking open that door. Strain GFAJ1, the bacterium, is a different way to do business. Just to open the possibility to what else is possible. It has solved the challenge of being alive in a very different way than we knew of. What other questions can we ask? This will inform us about life on our own planet, and it will help inform us of life. We will find it one day elsewhere in the universe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Felisa. And now I'm going to turn it back over to you, Duane.
Thank you all. And Felisa, congratulations to you and your team. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, now we get to the question and answers to really even flush it out even more. We're going to start here first and then go to the West Coast. I'm going to ask you to wait for the microphone, give your name and affiliation. And obviously we have folks here, and we also have a professor in Arizona, so if you can address your question to the appropriate person, that'd be great. Let's start with Mark Kaufman.
Thank you, and congratulations. What I'm intrigued by and trying to understand is you refer here to substitution of the arsenic. Is there reason to believe that this was substitution that occurred in any kind of a time frame, or is it possible that this is something that has been in the bacterium or in other bacteria going back to the beginning of time?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, we'll have the next 30 years at least of my career and many others to begin to probe that. I think what it does suggest, I'm saying substitution because we really just want to open this package to be able to think about what else life could be. And as an early career scientist, I think that's a safe way to go. But in terms of whether I think if it just happened recently, substituting for what was or how old this is, I think we can begin to address those questions. There's a number of experiments I can think of, and I know many of my colleagues who have been familiar with this work for a number of months now have suggested. What we can say, and dangerously to speculate just a little bit, if you'd let me, is that phosphate, and it's phosphate in biomolecules, so phosphorus, and I'll go between those, you'll have to pardon me, on Earth is locked up in rock. So your bones are made of phosphate, because it's a good idea. And it's very, one of the reasons it just doesn't do a lot of chemistry. And in fact, I hope that Steve would agree in that phosphate chemistry is very difficult. And we can speculate a little bit about, can be very difficult. We can speculate about, and we have no evidence of how life yet started. Okay, given that, there are a number of scientists who propose that in hydrothermal vent systems where we have a gradient, so different chemicals coming together, arsenic would have been available for prebiotic chemistry. Whether it was or not, I can't we can't speak to. I wasn't there. But it does chemistry rapidly. It can do chemistry more rapidly. So I think that it will be a fun thing to try and test, but it's not an easy problem.
Randy Shostak, reporter with EOS, the newspaper of the American Geophysical Union. How does and might this finding affect NASA's and others' astrobiology programs, including the Mars Science Lab and other ongoing and planned missions and programs?
Do you want me to?
You can start.
All right, I'll start then. With respect to Mars Science Laboratory, or in general, the problem of studying habitability on other planets, the way that one could be affected is to think more broadly about what sorts of environments one might characterize as habitable. In specific, with respect to experiments that we could do on Mars Science Laboratory, we do have payload investigations that can measure the chemical elements. We do have a payload investigation that I'm associated with that can actually measure organic molecules. So one way that you can tell what you have is by putting together a number of investigations. And like all science, independent lines of corroboration help you paint a bigger picture. So for example, on Mars Science Laboratory, if you had an environment that appeared to be rich in arsenic or some unanticipated metal, and you also had a finding of organic molecules, you could begin to put a picture together about what the environmental chemistry might portend.
And I'll take a shot at that. I think this finding points to a challenge that we've known we've had for a while. Clearly, if we went to another planet or another body in the universe and we saw a human, we would recognize it as life. And there are many other forms we could probably recognize. The challenge of finding something that is significantly different than terrestrial life and life as we know it is really what plagues us when we think about spending the money that we do, developing the instruments that we do, and sending them off on a mission. And so I think it's been our strategy, with the support of the scientific community, to think as broadly as possible, to put measurements that we may deem reasonable in a context, so make the context of the environment, to explore possibilities that are not so focused on a specific molecule. For example, we would not want to at this point necessarily go to look for specifically DNA that had arsenic in its backbone. We want to keep them very broad and keep our strategy in seeking signs of life open to the possibility of things. We would hate to go somewhere and not see it.
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon. My name is Luis Fernando Silva Pinto from TV Globo in Brazil. My curiosity is whether the door that you say has been opened will take scientists more in the direction of looking for different environments for life here on Earth or outside. And if you had to pick another element, another medium, other than arsenic, which one would you explore first?
So I'll answer the back end of your question first. And I'll tell you, I have a lot of ideas. And we all knew how ideas, propagated through the nets. And so I'd love to talk to you offline about that. But there's a lot, I have a long career ahead, and I have a lot of ideas I'd like to test. So I think we have lots of questions in terms of other elemental substitutions, other types of metabolism. Not just the way you make a cell, but also the way the cells can do their business. So I won't really talk any more about that right now, but I'd say stay tuned for the next 15 to 30 years. Let's say that. That said, the front end of your questions in terms of looking here on Earth or elsewhere, I think yes and yes. I think that we can learn a lot here, not just my work, but many of the folks, the other scientists supported in the astrobiology program. And again, astrobiology, the study of life in a planetary context. We don't want to be Terran-centric, Earth-centric. Life in any planetary context, or asteroid context, or moon context. I think it's all very important. And so I guess what I'd say is I'm happy to be involved in both of those. And perhaps Mary, you want to address that? That answers your question.
Right here. Give your name and affiliation, please.
Sure. Eloisa Villela from TV Record in Brazil. I was wondering, from what I understood, you now open two different doors here, or many more, but one is exploration life as we knew, so expanding the idea of what life is and where it can be sustained. And the other that I was wondering if you could comment a little more is possible practical applications here. Like the professor mentioned, the water waste treatments or recovery of phosphorus, or what kind of other possible applications you see?
I think we're going to direct that to Jim, since he introduced that and is our phosphorus expert. Jim, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. So, yeah, this is all new and spinning out, so a lot of the things just come into your head instantaneously. So, for example, tying together the bioenergy and the phosphorus sustainability issues. So we know we have to begin to develop alternative bioenergy sources for fossil fuels, and so people are growing a lot of plants and trying to figure out a way to grow algae to make bioenergy, but all of the existing plants and algae that we know of need fertilizer themselves. They need phosphorus themselves. So what if someone was clever enough to be able to develop a bioenergy creature, a microorganism based on this metabolism, if it holds up, that doesn't need phosphorus? So you don't need to drain the fertilizer supply in order to solve the bioenergy problem. So we're a long way off, but I mean, I would think that this, if this holds up and if we can figure out a way to do it, right, then you can have a whole bioenergy technology that's based on an arsenate type organism. That's kind of science fiction. Probably more realistic are things like treating arsenate waste dumps and this sort of thing to find organisms that are capable of tolerating that or, in fact, thriving on that, as this one does. So there seem to be applications for toxic waste treatment where arsenate is often often an issue. So I think that's another practical aspect that people will start to work on once we start to learn more about this situation. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting to think about the possibility of organisms and living things that might be able to live without phosphorus. And, for example, just going back to the bioenergy situation, one of the big problems that bioenergy schemes have is that if you make an algae or a cyanobacteria-based bioenergy system with regular organisms, pretty soon it's going to get infected with other organisms, like it's going to be invaded by things you don't want. Well, one way you could avoid that is that all those other invaders are probably going to need phosphorus, and so if you had a phosphorus-free environment with a bioenergy organism based on arsenate instead, that's going to be pretty resistant to being contaminated by invaders that you don't want. So I think, you know, there's pretty exciting stuff here if this holds up.
I could also comment, I think, on the end of that, Jim, and that, so if this microbe has been something we knew, so when I said it looked ordinary, also what it does is very ordinary. So you and I breathe oxygen and we burn sugar. Same thing this microbe does. So metabolically, scientifically we'd say metabolically, it's not very interesting. It's something very normal in terms of its metabolism. And the way it looks, again, we would look in the environment. We may not know that one thing, and it wiggles, it moves really fast, they swim quite rapidly. We may not notice that, oh, that microbe is making its biomolecules out of some other element. So if for every one of your cells in your body right now, there are 10 microbial cells, so you are mostly microbe, what might we not understand about those microbes? So that's in you. Now let's go global. So on planet Earth, we know that it's very well supported now that microbes are some of the major drivers of the biogeochemical cycles on Earth, like carbon cycle. So if microbes are doing are these major players in our own bodies and in the Earth, so on our planet, if we're missing a population maybe based on arsenic, but maybe these other possibilities that we don't even know yet, I think it has vast implications in understanding the way our own bodies might work and help inform us about that, but also in the way our planet works. So that I think it's, I think Jim suggested in practical applications that it's absolutely. But some of the practical applications will develop over time to understand, well, here's the fundamental discovery. And, you know, it's going to take an army of scientists, not just myself and my team, but other people to bear on this problem with their tools and their ideas.
I think it's clear from both of their answers that we're opening up all sorts of new areas of research. Jim, you're practically breathless with your ideas. Well, I'm sure you'll be looking for money soon. So, you know, the ramifications of this finding are pretty significant.
before we go to the West Coast, we have some time for the gentleman here. You can give your name and affiliation, sir.
Sure. It's Ivan Semenik with Nature. I just have two very short technical questions. Not technical questions, but just detailed questions. I'm wondering about the fraction of the swap out. The video kind of implied all the phosphorus molecules disappearing or atoms disappearing being replaced with arsenic. Do you have a sense of whether it's that complete or whether it's some fraction and if there's some level, some threshold there? And for Steve Benner, if you could just clarify what it is about arsenate that makes it a weaker link specifically.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to understand what the level of explanation should be, how the explanation should be crafted to meet the level at which you're interested in an answer. Arsenic has, of course, a position below phosphorus on the periodic table that has been mentioned. Because of that, it has orbitals, which we chemists like to talk about, d orbitals, f orbitals, that are lower in energy. And that permits arsenate to fall apart as by what is called in the business an associative mechanism. That is, the attacking water doesn't have to wait until something leaves in order to attack. It attacks without waiting for something to leave. And that's quite different than what molecules farther up in the periodic table do. And so this is why, again, my curmudgeon wet blanket rolls, I sit here and say it's wonderful to say they were going to go to other planets and get a phosphorus-free energy, right? What we believe, based on prior experience, is that what will certainly survive from Felice's work is the microbe. And that microbe, if it grows in low phosphorus environments, that's wonderful. I mean, that can be used practically. But we don't believe right now that the body of evidence saying that that molecule can't exist at the present time overwhelms the body of evidence that says that molecule does exist. And that's not a theoretical argument. That's an argument based on empirical. I'm sorry, yes.
Let me come in the back end of that, and maybe I should have answered first. And it's true what Steve's saying. I'd like to let him...
No, get the wet blanket off.
So, disposing with the wet blanket, what I will say is what we've presented, so that was an artist's rendition, absolutely, to illustrate the point, if you're not so familiar with seeing those molecular structures. I think what we've presented, the parsimonious way to interpret this, arsenic was absolutely associated with the DNA fraction, purified on a gel. To address what Steve's saying, how it survived all the manipulation, if you're aware of how we do DNA extraction, unknown. It migrates at a different level. I'll be a bit technical for a second. Migrates at a different rate. I think it's supercoiled. I've done things like cesium chloride gradients. Again, a little bit technical. It's weird. And I'll be honest, that I've been asked a question like, well, what did you think? Were you a eureka? No, I'm a biochemist. I said, this isn't right. Something's wrong. I must have made a mistake. And you'll see there's a laundry list of fantastic co-authors. And I got a reputation at meetings. Somebody would give a talk, whoa, I think that's a type of mass spectrometry, you could do this. And so they see me coming. They wouldn't know who I was, but they knew that I was going to ask them to measure something for me. And often I asked them to do it blindly. And they often said, and if I were there, we would stare at the data, and they would sit back, very experienced scientists. Well, what am I looking at? No. What do you think it looks like? No, Felisa, what's in the sample? No, what do you think it looks like? It's often 2 a.m., you know. So the answer, from my viewpoint, in how much arsenic is substituting, I think right now we don't know. If you look at the data that we're presenting in the paper, it varies. And again, to be technical for one moment, we've measured these cells in stationary, so it's old age for the cell. So they've reached a point, you grow, stop. And so the idea there is there... Normally, we run experiments a little differently. So if you look on our supplementary evidence, we've showed all, we're very transparent. There is absolutely some phosphorus left in these cells. But what's unambiguous about those numbers is it is not enough to support the growth that we observe. Right? 2.8 femtograms. It's just not enough. So to support that growth, we can estimate what we call this in science, the back of the envelope calculation. We can squint and see that pattern in nature that our data are telling us, we can estimate how much total phosphorus you need at a very low, how many ribosomes, how much you need in the genome, how much you need on your proteins to turn them on and off. It's called protein phosphorylation if we have the analogous problem with arsenic. How much you might need in lipid. It's just too little. It's just flat out too little. Do we have a crystal structure yet? No. I have collaborators working on that. Do we know the genome yet? No. But we're going to work on that. And the point was, it could be maybe it's just A's and T's. Maybe it's just G's and C's. Maybe it's one out of every 10 or two out of every 4. Great question. So what we're not suggesting, in my paper, I tried to write it in a very clear manner. What I'm not suggesting is that if the entire microbe is made of arsenic, absolutely not. I'm very, very transparent. My co-authors, we spent a lot of time being very careful. We're not really speculating. We wanted to present the phenomena to the community and to the public. Say, oh my gosh, this is amazing. If you notice how I end it, you know, I had been reviewing some of the greats. I stand on the shoulders of giants, and I know that. I went to Mono Lake because it's well-studied. It's easy accessible. It's in the United States. We studied with an American team on American soil with American money. And I went to this to really, you know, I reread the double helix paper, and I reread Stanley Miller's paper and plate tectonics. Just present the observation and the data so that we can make those forward progress. I think understanding how much, what does it do during log growth? Let's say we give it arsenic and phosphorus. What happens? I actually know, but I'm not going to talk about it here today. I'm well on to the next paper, so I'm a little more confident than I would have normally been with someone as esteemed as Steve Benner in the room. I've been working on the next paper, should be submitted in February.
Maybe we can turn the question back to our colleague from Nature. I mean, the question is, you've taken a biochemistry course, and what do you remember from your metabolic pathways that you were taught, forced to memorize for the examination, and perhaps promptly forgot? So when you biosynthesize DNA, right, the phosphate comes from nucleoside triphosphate, where the phosphorus that ends up in the DNA is the one directly bound to the ATP, deoxy-ATP, deoxy-GTP, and so on. And that phosphorus gets to that species by a 17-step metabolic pathway, which I'm sure you can write out on a piece of paper.
I got to interrupt you, Steve. Sorry. Sure. AMAS, adenosine monoarsenate, which would be, you saw that backbone we went down the, I call that the roller coaster when we made the animation. One of those nucleotides, so ATGC that you're all hopefully familiar with, has a sugar as a base and the phosphate. AMAS forms spontaneously in a test tube, while AMP does not. And so in terms of thinking about, he hasn't read the paper. So AMAS does form spontaneously in a test tube on the order of minutes, while AMP requires an enzymatic system. This isn't my work. This was done in the 80s. It was to understand, it was actually an accident of the finding, and I'd be happy to give you the citation, and we cite it in the paper. It was to understand the toxicity of arsenic. AMAS forms spontaneously at room temperature in a test tube.
Abiotically. That's not the phosphorus that ends up in the DNA.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in here. This is getting into a scientific debate here. We have some questions from the West Coast, and following, you guys can get together and hash it out. let's go to the West Coast, the Ames Research Center. We have questions. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Rob Artigo at KGO Radio in the Bay Area. And the question should be directed to Dr. Wolf-Simon. As to your non-Eureka moment, apparently you didn't suspect this might be the case or hypothesize that this might be the case. What were you doing at the moment? What were you looking for at the moment that you stumbled across this? Or did you, in fact, think potentially this was the case?
I'm sorry, I don't exactly understand the question. What was I doing at the particular moment in terms of what of the analyses or what kind of experiments I was running?
But, look at it this way. What were you looking for so that you you didn't hypothesize that this microbe lived as it did or as it does, but you found it anyway? I mean, that happens all the time in science.
I'm sorry, perhaps we were unclear. I had been thinking about the idea of arsenic substituting for phosphorus for some time. So it was an absolutely directed test. The question I was asking was, can arsenic substitute for phosphorus in a living microbe? So I ran the experiment where we grew it in a broth, in a liquid, an artificial liquid, where we gave the mud from Mono Lake as the initial source of the microbes everything it needed, except no phosphorus with a high dose of arsenic. So I'm sorry if that was unclear. This was a directed search. Does that answer your question?
We'll go to the next question. I think that did. We have USA Today on the line. Go ahead.
USA Today. A lot of our readers are already commenting online. They're disappointed you didn't pull an E.T. out of a hat and have him dance on the stage. I was wondering if you could talk about those expectations. You know, our readers have been expecting a walking, talking alien. Can you put this into perspective for them instead of what you found?
That's a question in perspective of the speculation was fiction, the facts.
Right. Yeah. I guess what I would say is that while certainly being able to announce the discovery of an extraterrestrial would be an incredible announcement, we feel that from our perspective and our understanding of biology here on Earth and what we base all the research that we do, because in astrobiology, to some extent, on our laboratory Earth, this is a phenomenal finding. We are talking about taking the fundamental building blocks of life and replacing one of them with an unusual, or with a perhaps not unpredicted, but another compound. In our mind, this is the equivalent, and there are some of us that remember seeing these original Star Trek episodes and others that maybe see them on rerun on TV land. But if you remember, is it Dark Evil and the Horta? So this is, in our mind, the equivalent of finding that Horta, which is a silicon-based life, substituting carbon, which is what we think all life forms are made of, with silica. Now we're talking about an organism that we think, if not replacing all of it, it appears to be using another fundamental component of life. The story isn't entirely carbon. Nitrogen, phosphorus, the other elements we mentioned are important as well. It's replacing phosphorus with arsenic. This is a huge deal. This is, you know, we mentioned it's going to require at least some paragraphs in a textbook to be rewritten, perhaps. And, you know, this is a big finding. And so that's, I'm sorry if they are disappointed, but there are lots of people, including Jim and the future research he's already planning, that see this as a huge finding and a significant finding that's going to lead to new areas of research and will fundamentally change how we define life and therefore how we will look for it. Maybe we'll be able to find ET now because we've got more information about what we might be looking for.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to keep this under an hour, so I'm going to take one more question. We have many more, but we can do that as follow-ups. So Irene from Discovery, you go ahead and have the last question and then swing it back to me and we'll close out. Go ahead, Irene.
Thanks very much. Actually, I have two questions. The first is about the experiment itself. How much time passed before the microbes were able to make the transition from their normal media to one that was primarily arsenic? And then for Steve, maybe if you could just maybe generally discuss a follow-up experiment that would leave you more of a believer. That'd be really helpful. Thank you.
So I'll answer first, apparently, this time. I learned that lesson quick. In terms of the time frame, the microbes never experienced normal, what you might call normal environment. I went straight from the environment, straight from Mono Lake, into this artificial lake water where we mimic what the lake would look like. We add everything it needs, again, vitamins and sugar and everything else. Just no phosphorus and lots of arsenic. So there was never a transition period.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. Keep in mind that, as I think I mentioned a moment ago, I think that the organism, the reported organism, will survive scrutiny. I think that this is going to be a very important organism for us to study to try to understand how an organism adapts to phosphorus-poor and arsenic-rich environments, because certainly me as an organism cannot do so. The kinds of experiments that I would, of course, start with would be I hate to be too technical, but radioactive isotope labeling experiments. Felisa did do some work with her paper with radioactive arsenic. There's also radioactive phosphorus. I would be looking at, for example, that band on the gel in figure 2A, the one in lane 2 with a box around it, for those of you who have the paper, looking at that by arsenic radioactive autoradiography, arsenic radioactive imaging, after I had fed radioactive arsenic to the bug, and to see whether it's in fact concentrated in that band. I would certainly, of course, do the same thing with radioactive phosphorus in a ratio. I would start with a lot of phosphorus and little arsenic, both labeled, to a lot of arsenic and little phosphorus, both labeled, and see how the labels, because radioactive labels are very easy to see in a cell, see how they evolve in time. And I mean, but Felisa, you know, I mean, I think you've actually got the sense of this, but when Felisa and I have talked about this for hours, may not days, the disagreement in science need not be personal. It can be factual, friendly, and constructive that way. The NASA Astrobiology Institute sort of emphasizes that, and the astrobiology program overall brings us together in a way that we, you know, have different backgrounds, different contexts, different cultures, and therefore we approach problems differently, and therefore the standards of proof that each of us have to meet in our respective communities are different. And so what you're seeing here is a perfectly healthy interaction between two different communities as we try to apply our standards of proof to somebody else's results. So these are the kinds of experiments as a chemist I would do next.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up. And for the media, and there are many on the line and elsewhere, these incredible scientists will be available for follow-up interviews. I want to thank the panelists and, of course, the Jim down in Tempe. Kudos again to you, Felisa, and your team. I also want to acknowledge the continued incredible work of NASA's Science Mission Directorate, which continues to awe and inspire the world with scientific discoveries. You can get all of the information on www.nasa.gov. And for those who know me, you know I cannot leave without saying it. Science never sleeps. Thanks for joining us.